Welcome to the Meltzone Podcast. This is episode 62. I'm Tom.
And I'm Stefan. And on today's episode, we are going to talk about why Tom might need a new studio. On other sad things, maybe just something we have already talked about a bit last time, another YouTube channel got hacked and all the videos got basically deleted and a crypto scam started running on the channel. And we quickly talk about how hard it might be to get someone's livelihood taken away by just the blink of an eye, basically. Then another like interesting story or just a nice thing that I figured out and started using since last week. I integrated my 3D printer into my home assistant, home automation system, which now sends me notifications when a print is finished. And I find that so handy. On a last news topic, a marketing agency basically, I don't know, tried to promote themselves by giving a list of how to use influencers in a way that they are getting, so the marketing agencies are getting the most benefit and the influencers themselves are basically getting nothing and just used as a free marketing tool. And yeah, we talk about how shady that is and how that might also, or how that is affecting the business Tom and I both are in.
Hey man, just be happy that you get free stuff, right? You just want to have another crappy whatever product, right? Anyway, questions. We answer a lot of questions today, including about sandpaper, why it's different between the US and the EU. We get into Voron versus Bamboo versus Prusa XL, the ups and downs of each of those platforms. Spoiler, two of those aren't really released yet, but yeah, very, very different machines. Stay tuned for that. A follow-up to my nozzle size video, 0.4 is obsolete. Why can't you just keep using a 0.4 and tell your printer it's a 0.6? There might be some things that may not work as well as you might think. And finally, a quick note on the positron printer and whether either one of us is going to end up building one.
So man, how's it going? I can hardly believe that we managed to stick to our 2-week schedule for the last two or three episodes.
Yeah, it's... The thing is, if you have sponsors on videos, like they push you to stick to a schedule. I know I've said this before, but it's pretty good for a podcast and it's pretty good for regular videos. Today we don't have a sponsor, so yeah. I guess thank you all for watching these videos and for supporting us in other ways. Like that is very much appreciated. That's the sponsor spot for today, I guess.
Sponsored by us.
Yeah, we're paying
sponsored
for
by
this
our
one.
Time.
We're paying for this one all by ourselves.
Yeah, we made an astonishing $52 last month with that podcast.
With and that is YouTube ad revenue.
That's YouTube ad revenue. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how we make money with these podcasts.
Yeah, it definitely helps with our scheduling now because it also helps me in planning. So
I guess maybe the big step was just to say, hey, let's make an appointment in 2 weeks and yeah. Then we're going to record and not just like, hey, you're free tomorrow, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Bad. Yeah, so I hope you guys enjoy more regular episodes as well. We still ramble too much, I guess, even though there aren't that many topics, but maybe they're going to get a little bit shorter. And today, at least, there aren't that many topics. I guess it's summer.
Oh, we do have topics. Come on.
We do have topics. Yeah. We have a ton of questions to answer. But yeah, it's summer. Not that much is happening. I see that in at least my YouTube views, in shop sales, in, I don't know, spending my own time. I'm going to be on holiday the next couple of days. It's charging up the batteries for fall and winter, I guess.
That is good for you.
That is good for me. Yeah. So.
I've got a bit of a ramble and a bit of a complainy section to start with here. If you don't care about those, there are timestamps in the show notes, and some players pick those up. But on YouTube, it also has the timestamps, so you can skip the rambly parts if you wish. But yeah, we both have studios. Well, let's see how long that both still stands up, because it looks like my landlord's wanting to kick me out. I had such a good intro plan for this, where you go like, "Hey Tom, how are you?" And I go like, "Hey, do you want the American rhetorical question greeting? How are you, or are you honestly asking?" But
we still made it there. So why is he wanting to kick you out?
So I guess I got to be very careful with defamation. So I'm not talking about a specific landlord. My address is not public. The name is not public. And I'm going to refer to the landlord as they, because that would give away information. But apparently they have issues with the neighbors that I talked to. And yeah, old stuff digging up. And you move into a new space, you move into a new neighborhood. This is the commercial era, and you're just like, "Hey, yep, cool, hi, I'm Tom. I don't want any trouble with you. I just want to do my thing, okay? I'm gonna board up my shop. I'm gonna be in my studio. I'm gonna do whatever I want. You guys do yours, okay? We're good. I'm not gonna bother you. We're cool." But you get dragged into this garbage, and whether you want it or not, you become a part of it somehow. And apparently my landlord person doesn't like me talking to the neighbors that he has an issue with. And I'm just like, I can't move in and be enemies with the same guys that you are enemies with. I just want to get along with the neighbors. I don't want my tires sliced. I don't want a rock in my windows. I just want to be a peaceful critter, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I got enraged WhatsApp voice messages one night, I guess you can imagine the typical Bavarian grumble that's in there. If it's like that, then I want you out of here as quickly as possible. And I was like, dude. And the thing is, I mean, I just moved in here, what was it, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 6 months ago, actually 6 months ago, half a year ago. I spent those 6 months kitting this place out, coming up with solutions, moving everything, and I'm just now at the point where I'm moved in, and that's all for nothing, that's all waste. So that's 6 months of my life plus probably 50 grand or something down the drain. Whether he actually kicks me out or not, I've not received an official termination, but you can't rent from someone like that who's just on a, what was it, a Friday night at 10:30 p.m. Threatens to kick you out. You can't work with someone like that. Someone who's that impulsive and uncontrolled, it doesn't work. So I'm going to have to look for something else again for the fourth time now. And it's just, man, I'm just defeated. We've briefly chatted about this before we started recording here, but it's you try and build something. And I like when you have control over stuff, when you can, hustle culture, you put more work in, you get a better result, you get somewhere, you build something for yourself. But I'm at a point where it's well, I can put in as much effort as I want, and I'm not getting anywhere. I don't have control over this, and it's just frustrating. And I'm do I move back into the basement studio? Do I do scale down? Be like, oh, screw this. I'm doing one video a month. That's got to be enough. Or do I now again look for commercial plots that I can put something on and spend the money on that and the effort? I just want to do 3D printing videos and produce those in peace and just work at those and live a peaceful influencer life. Why?
I don't envy you for that. And as I told you before, I really hope that still things gonna work out in some way, and I don't know, either everything's going to be all right again, or you at least have the peace and the time to make a proper decision and find something or build something for yourself. But
yeah,
that's the thing with like not having your own property and just neighbors in general. But
yeah, you're just everyone you depend on is like one more thing that's like that's out of your control. I very much dislike that. And yeah, I can fully understand everyone who like grows old and tired of the world. what's the character Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino? You know the guy. You know the gifs. I fully understand everyone who does that, and everyone is like, "Well, I'm out. I'm going to move into a cabin in the mountains with no internet and no running water." Full understanding. Like I'm with you guys 100%. Okay, that's that. Let's move on. I don't want to worry about that.
Man, I can just wish you all the best. Thanks. For that. I really hope that it's gonna work out. Hopefully it will. It would be a pity doing it again. But let's stop right here and get back to more positive vibes.
Sure. At least so this is something that's at least not bothering us
directly.
Indirectly. Well, it could happen to you too. It's those insurance ads, right? Yeah. So you put this one in there.
Yes. So on the, topic of your whole livelihood being taken away in just one blink of an eye. So last time we talked about Corridor Crew and how I got to watch their videos when I was sick a couple of weeks ago, and I really enjoyed it. So when I was preparing the show notes for the last episode, I wanted to add their channel URL into the description, into the show notes. And I quickly got into my YouTube account and looked for them, and I wasn't able to find them anymore. I did a YouTube search, also only found their, I guess it's second channel where they only have like finished videos in there. It's called Corridor.
It's the main channel. It used to be the main channel. But it switched around.
And in the end, I actually linked that and I was really confused why I'm not able to find the proper one that I have been watching for, during the 2 weeks when I was sick. So as it turns out, their channel was hacked. So somehow some external person was able to get a hold of their like login credentials and even somehow got around the two-factor authentication and just renamed the channel, started a live stream with, I don't know, some kind of a crypto scam on there.
I was going to say, yeah, crypto scams like crypto scam. Most obvious thing right now.
And of course, not deleted, but privated all their videos. And it took them over half a week to get everything back up and running again with the help of YouTube. And this is something really scary. They are at least 10 person team or something like that.
Oh, they're just bigger than that. They are bigger than that, yeah. I think they're like up to 20 or something right now
with everything.
So Corridor is like a full video production studio. I think we've talked about their own Patreon like site. Yep. They've got that running. That they're producing like three or four shows, regular shows for that. They're producing for video for YouTube. They're producing for external partners. Like they've got a partnership with Netflix right now that they're producing Punch for Punch with. So they're a proper production studio. This Corridor Crew channel was their main outlet. So have you watched the video, their explanation thing? Okay.
And we also going to link that below.
Okay. To the correct channel this time. So was it really like getting around two-factor authentication, or was there just like one weak link? That because that's usually what it ends up being, that there's like one account who has access to the channel who didn't have 2FA enabled or
whatever. I think it was something like that. I think they didn't want to get into full details, but
obviously, yeah. Okay, yeah.
The thing is, the channel was gone. They did not have the possibility anymore to, I don't know, change things, and they weren't able to directly find out what the source of everything was. And yeah, as I said, half a week later, everything was up and running again. And this served me as a gentle reminder to have two-factor authentication turned on everywhere, having proper unique passwords for every account, maybe also changing them regularly.
I don't know how much changing passwords actually does. If you've got a proper 16 character randomly generated one that you store in a password manager, then yeah, I don't think there's a need to change unless there's been like some breach, but then it's just that specific site that's had the breach and they should notify you anyway.
Yeah. And if I think back, so the French also 3D printing YouTuber Heliox3D, the exactly same thing happened to her as well a year or two ago. I can't really remember when it was, but for her it also like basically happened the same way. Somehow somebody got access to it, privated all of her videos, and I think actually blackmailed her.
Yeah.
So I guess you can do two things. Either just do crypto scam or blackmail somebody. She also, with her like YouTube partner and just contacts at YouTube, they were able to restore the channel as well. But in some way, of course, it scares you as hell. And on the other hand, this could potentially do also longer lasting damage to your channel.
Yeah, because it's not just, oh yeah, we've restored your channel, we've like put all the videos back on public, like all it, we've reverted your channel. The thing is also with YouTube, things work in mysterious ways, especially like pleasing the algorithm. I don't think that's going to get compensated, that your channel was gone for a week and that, you know, you got no views, your videos got no views. I think even if they got it restored completely, that's gonna make a dent on views.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it will. So just a reminder also, I guess for me as well, to check two-factor authentication and things like that.
Yeah.
And maybe for you listeners out there, just always think about the worst when you...
Well, the thing is, how much can you worry about? Like the worst would be somebody breaks into your home and takes the SSD out of your computer.
Yeah,
that's like the worst. But BitLocker, I mean, you can go overboard, but like do the reasonable things. Two-factor authentication isn't that hard. Unique passwords, like you said, use a password manager. They make life a lot easier.
Man, we should have gotten a password manager promo in here. Would have fit perfectly.
Yeah. Have I ever done one with? I don't think I have.
I have done one. You, so
who was that?
It was NordPass. So there are a bunch of them around.
NordVPN. Okay.
Yeah. NordVPN. So, but not sponsored right here.
Yeah.
But maybe just helps you with unique passwords. Yeah. Anyways, I would suggest to continue on, or do you have something to add?
Nah,
I have a more 3D printer engineering and just quality of life improvement topic right here, and that is printer monitoring with Home Assistant. So what is Home Assistant, Tom?
Home Assistant is a... I can't do that. So you're running Home Assistant, I'm running Home Assistant. Basically, it's a tool that you run either like in a virtual machine or as a Docker or somewhere installed that gives you like...
I run it on a Raspberry Pi.
Okay. That also works. They have images for that. It's pretty easy to set up. And it basically connects all these smart devices in your home into one platform. So for me, for example, I've got my Hue lights, I've got my vacuum robot, I've got... That's pretty much it. So there are integrations for everything. So you can integrate the cameras, you can integrate your smart TV, you can integrate your smart fridge. I'm mostly using it. I'm feeding it data through MQTT for all my solar photovoltaics, monitoring, load management, just to get some graphs. But really, it is meant as like a smart home communications and control center. And of course, that opens up, you know, ways to integrate everything that has some sort of connectivity, including, in this case, Octoprint. So you found an integration for Octoprint is what they call basically the plugins that interfaces with other parts or with other devices out of Home Assistant.
Which I didn't use. I just put it in the show notes because people would otherwise remind me of that. And I'm not even sure if Gina did that herself, because I think she's also pretty fond on home automation and things
used
like that.
Used by 4.4% of the active installations.
There you
go.
Wow.
So, that is a lot.
That is a lot. So just let me tell you a quick story how I use Home Assistant and how it is most helpful for me. So we have the problem that we have kind of a moist basement, that we have photovoltaics on our roof.
Humid,
moist.
Uh-huh.
I think you could say both. Well, anyways, a humid basement. So...
yeah.
So just letting an air dryer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say air dryer? Yeah, an air dryer running.
Dehumidifier.
That's the right word. Dehumidifier running down in the basement 24/7 would make me poor, especially with like current energy prices here in Germany.
So photovoltaics.
Yeah, exactly. And there is Home Assistant. So what I started doing when we installed our photovoltaic system 2 years ago, my Home Assistant monitors how much energy I'm feeding to the grid. And at the point when I think I have been feeding 400 watts of energy to the grid for 5 minutes minimum, a Home Assistant will turn on a Wi-Fi switch, and on that Wi-Fi switch my dehumidifier is running. So, and a Home Assistant then just continues monitoring the photovoltaics. And as soon as I do take energy from the grid for at least 5 minutes to just have a bit of a hysteresis loop that it's not like pulsing on and off all of the time, the Wi-Fi switch will be turned off again. And this is really helpful for me, because especially during summer when we do have the humidity problem in our basement, the dehumidifier basically runs all day when the sun is out, which is helping us a ton with just keeping our basement dry and also just not smelly. And I loved it. And the problem was, I had it running for 2 years. The problem with Home Assistant is, because it's taking sensor readings all of the time, writing it into databases, and I'm running it on a Raspberry Pi, I have been just using a normal SD card. And SD cards are okay if you occasionally write things on them and putting like big chunks of data on them. But if you're constantly using them as a storage media, writing and reading data, they will degenerate and at some point just get useless and break. So unfortunately, I was lazy and I didn't notice that earlier. But I wasn't able to install the backup back on my new installation. Somehow it didn't work.
That's the golden rule of backups: check that you can actually use them.
I didn't check that. Anyway, so like 2 weeks ago, Home Assistant was just not working anymore. It didn't turn on the Wi-Fi switches again. I was barely able to log into Home Assistant again. It somehow sporadically worked. Anyways, there are actually SD cards around that are especially made for video surveillance. And they are, by a couple of factors, better in terms of number of writes and reads that they allow. So I purchased a new SD card, did a new installation of Home Assistant, and also purchased a couple of additional Wi-Fi plugs, especially Wi-Fi plugs that do have power monitoring, because I now not only know how long the dehumidifier is running, I also know how much power they use, yeah, because I'm interested in that. And I have them installed on my dryer and washer, and they automatically send me a notification on my phone when the dryer and the washer is finished, which is really handy.
Yeah, it's data. Yeah, sure. I mean, we're all, yeah, as nerds, we're always, yeah, interested in more data about all the stuff that we can monitor. But it also, yeah, gives you like actionable info, like, hey, washer, dryer, how much does a wash cycle actually use? Yeah. Does it make sense to run that right now when there's like this amount of yeah, solar out? Does it make sense to buy a new one that's more energy efficient? Mm-hmm. That sort of stuff.
Yeah. So, and I also installed one of the plugs on one of my Prusa machines just because I was interested if the power monitoring properly works and things like that. And at that point, I also realized, yeah, you do have the automation for the dryer and the washer to send you a notification when it runs, or when they're finished. Let's just do the same thing with the printer. So,
just to clarify, maybe for those that aren't fully following, the Wi-Fi plugs that Stefan's talking about are just like little intermediary plugs. You plug those into the wall, you plug your device into that plug, and the plug has a switch in it that can turn the device on or off, but it also continuously monitors how much power that device is drawing. Yeah. So, yeah.
So, the like Home Assistant notices when a print is running in a way that I think told it if the printer draws more than I think 40 watts from the wall for 10 minutes or 5 minutes, then it basically knows, okay, now the printer is running. And as soon as that energy draw drops back to below 10 watts for at least a couple of minutes, I know that the printer is finished, and it sends me a notification to my phone.
Okay. And so you don't even need the Octoprint integration for that. You're just doing that with like power monitoring.
Exactly. I currently do that with power monitoring, and I found that really handy because I don't have, like, for example, my Prusa in the same room as my office right here. And it just helped me to send me a quick notification. Print job is done. I can go downstairs, remove the parts, and start a new one. So that's something you can do without, in a way, interfering with the printer, just by power monitoring.
Yeah, you wouldn't even need Octoprint set up for that. It's mm-hmm. literally works with any printer. Those plugs are, I mean, I'm running seven of those as well. They are pretty good. They're pretty yeah. cheap for what they are. They're like $12 or something.
Yeah.
The only challenge with those is they only switch off one phase. So okay. if you get unlucky, you leave live on, because our EU plugs, you can plug them in upside down. You leave live on, and if you don't have a double insulated device, like that could potentially be live. Okay. So just to be aware of that, you know, they only switch one phase. But yeah, they're pretty great.
And since I know that there's also a Home Assistant integration for Octoprint, I thought I would add that in here as well. So if you are running Octoprint, maybe even on several devices, and you would like to get just notifications, and there are also notification plugins, I think, directly for Octoprint.
Oh, yeah.
But if you have a Home Assistant integration running, you can send this data, I think, over MQTT. Don't know.
It might just use the Octoprint API.
Something. And you could basically use that to also send notification when prints are done, but you could also just gather all of the remaining print times on your Home Assistant dashboard. And yeah. for someone who is maybe running a bigger print farm or just a couple of printers, that could be really handy. And if you already have Home Assistant installed, I would highly recommend to use one of these two methods, because they were just such an improvement in
convenience, I guess.
Inconvenience yeah. for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Home Assistant is built to be like the one-stop shop for all your connected devices, and having Octoprint there makes sense. Of course, if you don't have anything else in Home Assistant and you're just using it for Octoprint, then it doesn't really make sense to just use a different interface for those four key stats that it's giving you: printer state, percentage, finish time, start time. Yeah. you just go to Octoprint. But if you're if you've got Home Assistant running anyway, that totally makes sense.
No, I found that really handy. So the Bamboo Lab X1 with the app that they are running, it also sends notification when prints are done, which is really nice. And I just found that so handy the last weeks. Because, of course, for example, for the Prusas, you have a really good remaining print time estimation, but you don't always have like the print time in your head. And if you're doing, if you want to do a couple of prints one after the other, it's a really handy thing to just get the notification right when it's done, so you can switch or just remove the model and continue printing again.
Yeah, what I've been using, because I always switch between printers, and I don't, as much as I would love to, I don't have an Octoprint set up, because again, the printer moves around. You need to use it with like five different machines. I have this guy. This is a Google Nest battery powered camera, and I just plonk it down like next to the printer, something like this.
Yeah.
Plop, and it's good enough to read the LCD on the Prusa. So I can just check on my phone and get a live feed of whether the printer is working or not. This is what I use instead of Octoprint. Maybe not the most elegant solution, but because, I mean, it was going just a second ago. Because these are battery powered, you just, you know, they last for like a year if you only check in on them one, you know, a couple of times a week.
Okay.
These are great. They're kind of expensive for what they are. They're almost $200, but if you have one kicking around, I mean, who doesn't have like a €200 camera kicking around? these are very convenient. Other companies also make these for the same stuff. So that's what I've been using. Yep. Not as elegant, but it kind of works the same way. But I mean, I have been using Home Assistant as well for pretty much the same thing that you're describing with like your solar management, power management thing. For me, Home Assistant has mostly been just, I can show you guys on video here, has mostly just been a collection of graphs. And of course, it's offline because I don't have like the paid remote access stuff, just graphs and stuff. But it's only like a display. It's not an actual management interface because I tried Node-RED for like the logic and stuff, but I couldn't figure it out. I was too dumb for that. So I've written 2,000 lines of custom Python code to control it and to predict that. Way easier than figuring out Node-RED. Absolutely.
And this is maybe one of the last things I also need to add here, even though I would say I'm not the dumbest person and I am tech savvy. Setting up Home Assistant sometimes was challenging for me, to be totally clear. The community is growing and growing and growing, and there's a ton of resources on it. But in my opinion, starting with it can sometimes be a bit overwhelming, but you can do really cool things with that.
Yeah, that was like 1.5 years ago or something when I knew I wanted some sort of assistant smart home device, and it was Home Assistant or OpenHAB is the other big one. And Home Assistant honestly is so much easier than OpenHAB. with OpenHAB, it's like immediately, hey, here's the JSON, just fill this out, write this file, and then it's going to work. With Home Assistant, at least you have some graphical auto configuration, all that stuff. OpenHAB, at least in my experience, way more confusing. So probably the simplest solution is Home Assistant.
Cool.
Yeah, then one more thing that we can enrage ourselves over is the influencer playbook that Joel retweeted by some influencer manager dude person, Taylor Blackass. I was like, these are the 12 tweets. These are the 12 steps that I do to get influencers to work with me for like almost no money. And he's like, well, write him an email, be like, here's Tyler, can you follow up, make no commitments, and then bang him down when they don't post within 3 days about your product. agencies or like the people who think they know how to work with as much as everyone hates the word influencers, that honestly, I think those people like the leg ass dude, they are worse than the fake influencers, because they're just as fake and they're being annoying at the same time. The amount of emails that I get that follow that exact scheme, and the amount of emails that you get, I mean, I've briefly tweeted about this, it drowns out legitimate emails, legitimately interesting stuff. I've not responded to an email from E3D from 3 weeks ago, just asking how I got on with Obsidian, because it was there one day, and then 3 hours later, it was gone, because it was like, yep. Oh, I just wanted to follow up with this. Oh, hi, can we collaborate on this? It is at a point where it's not just annoying, but what's the word there? Debilitating? Encumbering? It is an actual issue that is making email a complete non... It's just not worth for me to check emails, because it's going to be 95% of those trashy... schemes,
yeah,
and five where I'm like, oh well, man, I wish I could work with you, but I can't give you exactly what you want, so like it's not going to be great, and then it just drowns everything out, right?
It is, and this is also one of the interesting like background stories of having a content creation business, that like the business side of the business, that what like the viewers don't usually see, is something that can take up so much time. It's crazy. And if you're having agencies like that basically annoying and harassing you all day, it doesn't make things easier. And you guys might think, we're complaining so much. You're getting free stuff. And yeah, of course we're getting free stuff, but at the end of the day, I can still remember getting my first 3D printer, and I was so stoked about that. And of course, at that point, YouTube wasn't paying my bills yet, so I had the feeling that the machine itself was payment enough for, I don't know, the thing that I did with it at that point. But at some point, I don't know, I can feed my baby with 3D printers.
Yeah,
I think she's not gonna like that, and
bit too tough to chew on. Yeah,
need to get one of these chocolate 3D printers. She'd be really happy about that.
You want me to hook you up with Pro Casino?
Pro Casino. Do you still have it?
No, that was a loaner unit, and okay. I actually like loaner units. I don't like it when companies send me machines to keep, but most of the Chinese ones are like, well, you know, it's going to be like $300 to send it back, and the printer is worth only $150, so like keep it,
and you have to disassemble it.
Yeah, and then they would get like a used machine back. So
but why do you prefer them? Because is that then you don't have that you don't then you don't feel that you have the responsibility to do something else with the machine, or is it just I have too many, they're just taking up space?
Yeah, exactly.
And even just disposing of them is too much work.
Exactly. It takes up too much space. That's the very simple answer. I've got two machines that I love that can do all the 3D printing that I need. That is one Prusa Mark III and one Voron. That's all the 3D printers that I need for the stuff I want to get done. And maybe a resin printer. Resin printers are cool for their specialty use cases. But I do not need 10 more Ender 3 clones. I do not need 12 different crappy laser cutters that are each one is going to shoot my out. Yeah. The thing is, with machines that are too crappy to use, you can't even give them away with Ghost Conscious. I think we've talked about this before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we've talked about that.
Joel is doing the right thing. He's carting his printers to Protopasta, and basically he's filling up his car. WRX doesn't fit that many printers. He's filling up something with printers and carting them to Protopasta, and he's like, hey, everyone who comes by gets a free printer. I think that's cool. Does that work here? I guess it would work here. But just the extra effort of having to dispose technically of 3D printers is just more effort than it's worth. I know everyone's screaming at us right now, being like, Well, just send them to me.
Yeah. And the thing is, and this is something we need to point out here, this doesn't mean that we are getting paid if we are doing reviews of printer. This is something I guess especially both of us are not doing at all. But yeah, if somebody has a machine and you're probably you have a proper disclaimer and they want you to get their product in front of an audience in like in a way a sponsored sponsored section of a video and things like that, this is something they just gonna need to pay for. That's just how it is. That's advertisement for them. And
yeah, I guess that the core difference is when it's a review, we decide what machines we review and we make up our we make up our mind about what exactly we say. And most of the time for me, that decision is, hey, I don't care about your machine enough to make a review about it. I don't think your machine is special enough to warrant a full video. So for most, or for actually 99% of the offers that I get, it's like where it's like, hey, I want to send you a laser cutter, a 3D printer, whatever. I'm just like, sorry, don't care. So of course, yeah, there's the option of companies paying for a feature or for a first look or for whatever else you want to call it. It's not a review. Some creators kind of mix that up where it's like, hey, they get paid for reviews in exchange for like not mentioning some things or emphasizing some stuff that maybe you wouldn't care much about, but that's a different thing. Where was it going with this? I don't know. I don't do paid reviews, at least, well, not if it's a review, if it's a recommendation or something that's supposed to help someone decide whether they should get a printer or not. You don't do the same thing. You don't do that either. I'm very, very public about that. I've got a whole site up on my website, thomsradio.org/review-guidelines, where it's like explicit. Hey, I don't take money for reviews, and I don't consider a printer payment for review because I don't care about your printer, to be honest.
And if you guys are watching and listening, I would definitely just look out for the word, yeah, this is a sponsored video, and if it's a sponsored video, just take everything with a pinch of salt, because when it's sponsored, we as a creator, we don't have full like creative control over your video. We're going to send the video out for review, and if they don't like something that we say, we will basically cut it out.
Yeah, that is part of the deal of any feature or, feature-sponsored video, whatever you want to call it. Everything you say is going to need to be approved by the brand. So some creators are more upfront about it when it's like, hey, this video is sponsored by X, which is what I think is the right thing to do. Others are a bit more weaselly, where it's like in the description down below, where it's like, thank you to X for supporting this video or sponsoring this video. But whenever it's like, whenever a creator is shouting out a brand and saying something like, thank you to X for supporting this or for, it's usually a hint that there was some payment for this content. And it's a gray area. Just a note. That is something that's happening. And of course, now you could get into the whole thing of like, hey, is an affiliate program that pays very well, is that not enough of an incentive to make a good review when they're paying like 15% of the revenue and you end up selling 100 machines? Well, that's more than they would usually pay for a featured video. I've not made peace with that either. I'm still conflicted about what's right there as well. But we do the best of our efforts. Okay.
Yeah. Let's end this right here. As I already said in the beginning, there aren't that many news topics at the moment, but we have a ton of questions that we're going to talk about. And if you guys have questions, leave them down in the comments of the YouTube video or tweet them to us at the Meltzone, and we try to answer them here on this podcast. So the first one is
sandpaper.
A comment. Yeah, sandpaper. The first one is about sandpaper. Shady Business is basically saying that. So let me start somewhere else. Tom last time talked about that he wants to test the Obsidian nozzle for wear resistant, and if nothing's gonna wear it, he might still have the possibility just to run it over sandpaper and see how that wears the nozzle down. On that method, Shady Business has been commenting, yeah, just pay attention, because European grit numbers, so the like 80, 120, 320 rating on sandpaper is different in Europe than it is in the US, and I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, me neither. Apparently, it is some other way of measuring sandpaper grits, but I've briefly looked it up, and the way it works essentially is up to, I think, 400, the grits are the same. So 120 is going to be the same in I don't know if it's Europe, or wherever the sandpaper border is. But up to 400, it's going to be basically the same grit. So you buy a 320 in the US, you buy a 320 in Europe, it's going to be the same thing. But then it starts diverging, and I think up to like 800 or 1200 is like a transitional area, and everything above that is like 2x. So a 1200 US sandpaper is going to be a 2500. Well, actually, I should put them at the same level. It's going to be a 2500 sandpaper in Europe, which is interesting because you watch, I watch YouTube like everyone else probably. And I see US woodworkers talk about like, yeah, I sand it up to 1200. And I'm like, cool, well, that's not very fine. That's like my, 1200 is relatively fine. Yeah, you'd use that as like a, before you apply primer, for example, that's 1200. But actually 1200 is like almost a pre-polish. 2500 is typically the finest type of sandpaper that we use. Maybe 4000, but I was not aware of that. It's another idiosyncrasy, I guess, between two different measurement systems. And I don't know which one's right. I don't know which one is more logical, but it's just different. It's different.
It is different. So thanks for that. Let's continue with the next one.
Joe Himes is asking, what advantage does Voron hold over bamboo at this time? And the next one also ties into this from Martin. Asking, hey, will the Prusa XL be obsolete when it comes out with all the delays? Thinking about bamboo, etc. So, Stefan, you're a bit more invested in all this. You have a Voron, you have a Prusa XL in pre-order, you have a bamboo. Why would you pick a Voron over a bamboo?
I guess for the moment, it would be size, of course, because you can get it up to 350 cubed or 400, even 400 cubed, something like that. It's basically scalable
up to
a certain point. The Voron. And the bamboo is limited in a way in terms of building volume. This might not be important for you, but this is definitely an advantage about the Voron.
Though there is a recommended max size, at least for the V2, of 350.
350,
350 is like what they're saying, hey, this is, don't go over this, or it's just going to be too floppy, which makes sense.
So this is definitely one of the advantages about the Voron. Then for the moment, it would be reliability, repairability, and part availability, for which is a plus for the Voron, because the Voron basically uses standard components that you can get, I guess, locally in most countries. Standard hot ends, standard nozzles, standard stepper drivers.
Essentially whatever you want to put into it, right? Exactly. I've built mine with Duet. Typically, it is clipper-based with, I don't know what the board is, but some SKR board, right? So you can build it however you want. With Bumby, you're going to have the official this is it. Solution. What is the price of the bamboo retail?
I think the bamboo, let's not include the, let me see. I think they now have a pre-order on their side. store.
So yeah, for reference, Voron is how much is it? A bit over $1,000 if you source it from like reliable sources, but you can easily spend a good bit more if you get like all the wiring harnesses and premium components. I guess you could build it for a bit under $1,000, but probably not worth it to cheap out.
I think the LDO Voron kit is around $1,500.
Okay, but that includes everything, right?
Everything, except the printed parts. Except the printed parts, and I think except, so LDO doesn't include a hot end, and LDO doesn't include a Raspberry Pi.
because those are not very available right now.
Yeah, so. But yeah, a Voron with the material is going to set you back, say around $2,000.
Okay.
The Bamboo Lab is currently on pre-order, and the X1 Carbon version without the AMS is $1,200.
Ooh.
Which is a very competitive price.
So how does the Prusa XL tie into this?
Prusa is, I think, $2,000 at least in its most basic configuration. But I think the Prusa XL is in a way different because it has the tool changing capability. Right. And even though the Voron and the Bamboo Lab, they are multicolor capable with an additional system. So on the Bamboo,
basically
it's the
like
AMS.
A pellet.
Or just with a pellet, exactly.
Or I mean, I don't know how the AMS works exactly, but I would assume it's like
multiplexing.
Simple
multiplexing.
Not a welder like the pellet, but just like 4-in-1 hot end.
Exactly, 4-in-1 hot end. Actually, you can even daisy chain 4 of these units to have 16-in-1 nozzle. And you can do basically the same thing. On the Voron, there is, I can't remember the name of the, I think it's not official, but kind of the multi-color thing that goes with the Voron. Anyways.
You can upgrade them all. I mean, if you really wanted to, you could hook up a Prusa MMU. You could build those yourself and just use a 5X multiplexer.
And they give you pretty decent multicolor printing. Multi-material is questionable if you don't have compatible materials. A multi-tool head printer will give you the opportunity to be way more free in that regard. If you need it, is a different question.
Yeah.
But yeah, so part availability, longevity of the printer and things like that. We don't have a ton of info how long a Bamboo Lab's gonna last, how good, for example, the carbon rods with the bearings will last, if they will wear out at some point. They do have kind of okay prices for spare parts at the moment.
Sure, but what about in 5 years? I think that's the bigger question.
Exactly. What about in 5 years? Availability is, I think, also still questionable at that point. They're going to set up local warehouses, but who knows how long that's going to take with the current situation on sourcing and COVID.
So I guess if anything
of the electronics fries, I think you won't be just able to buy a new main board.
So basically the way I understand it now is Bamboo is like the all custom, all proprietary platform that you're going to be reliant on Bamboo for, whereas the other two, I mean, the Prusa XL is going to be open source, I assume. If you want to, you could reprint parts or you could probably get them from Fizitech or whoever. If Prusa goes out of business, I don't think they will, but just in case that the parts are out there. So basically Bamboo proprietary custom parts and you, I guess that would put them more in a consumer, I don't want to say disposable, but it is that idea. Like you've got one integrated system that works as a unit and that's it.
Yeah.
Like it does this one thing and that's it.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm really interested in comparing at least the Voron against the Bamboo Lab. So the thing is, if we're talking about like advantages, we can also talk about disadvantages. And the disadvantage of a warren is that you need to build it yourself, that you need to wire it yourself, that you need to configure it yourself. And this is not something everyone is happy with, and maybe not everyone wants to spend that amount of time on such a printer. And for anyone who isn't comfortable with that, I would say, yep, go with the Bamboo, because it's out of the box, nice experience, works, is currently still supported. Not available at the moment, but I think you're going to be way more happy with it. But if you're looking for a nice project, then the Voron is definitely something that has been becoming way, way more comfortable to build as like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think as much as I'm probably going to get a shitstorm for that, I think some of the appeals of Voron, or one of the appeals of Voron, is the exclusivity, is the fact that it is not available as a build printer, or not as a, like, hasn't been available as a full kit for the longest time, high quality full kit, that you had to build it yourself. It's a bit of an exclusive club that you only get admission into if you spent the 30 hours to build one. So I think that's part of the Voron hype. It is a very good printer. Like, once it's built, it is an excellent machine and a love mine. But I think it's sort of the same thing that OnePlus originally used to market their phones, where it's like, yeah, you can buy them, but you're going to need an invite, and we're limiting those, and it's an exclusive club. And if you want to be one of the cool kids, well, maybe we're going to let you in, maybe not. it's maybe a bit of the same thing. So you have is your Voron running yet?
No, not running yet. Okay. That's a project for after my holiday. So probably going to start next week.
Okay. But yeah, I would have asked you, like, is the where is like the actual capability as far as like print speed? And I mean, tuning you do yourself on Voron, right? But is the Bamboo on par with the Voron as far as speed and quality and all that goes?
Oh, if you have ever seen a Bamboo running like in person, I guess it's hard to beat, especially since they optimized everything for being able to run that fast. And this is something they just did really well. And I still think that the Voron is going to be very capable, but I'm not sure if it's going to reach the same speed as the Bamboo. And maybe that's also a good segue to the Prusa XL, and something they have kind of hinted in their latest blog post, where they said, yeah, we're also working on speed. Of course, it's the Core XY, and you guys are going to expect that it's going to run faster. But I think they said, in order to defend themselves, that they probably not going to have the speeds of a Bamboo Lab, that speed also comes with responsibility. Speed also comes with issues. And I've seen that all the time when I'm using my Bamboo Lab. So layered adhesion is going to be challenging on PLA parts. Something that you are often going to see is that really fast areas are matte on the surface. Slower parts are going to be shiny, and those are all of the things you need to, well, either tune your profile, or you just need to be okay with it at the end, or maybe need to write material for that. It is fast, and for some material it is really great, but speed is not everything. Reliability is also something, and repeatability, especially if you're thinking about an industrial use case, where you want to produce a part, and the tenths and the hundredths and the thousandths part is going to be the same, and that's going to be challenging with a faster machine, and maybe one that you don't have that much control over as with a Prusa printer or
why the Ultimakers are printing so slowly?
Ultimakers has done their fair deal with printing faster, especially with the last firmware and also Cura releases. And well, you have a S3?
I have an original 3.
You have an original 3.
Which has been sitting in the basement for 3 years now. I loaned it out and it's just giving issues with the print cores. It doesn't see much use.
Okay. We have an S3. We have a 3 extended at work and an S5. And the thing I have always been really excited when seeing is the accelerations that they have been running for years on their machines, just because the print head is so lightweight and the kinematics are kind of made for being fast. They are not printing at the speed of, for example, a bamboo. Maybe they could, maybe they could not, but they have been trying to get productive parts out of the machine also in the past. I think it was their main selling point.
I've got a friend who's been using S5. I think they have 3 S5s at work. He's absolutely been hating those. He's been like, well, my 200 euro DIY machine prints faster and better than the S5s. Though that might, I don't know, it might just be down to the printers having been abused and like some weird profiles running on them. I don't know.
I won't comment on that point. Let me put it that way.
Okay. So, yeah. Let's move on. Before we enrage Ultimaker against ourselves here. Scott Bader is asking, hey, instead of a larger nozzle size, why can't you just put a 0.5 loud out of a 0.4 nozzle or use a 0.6 out of a 0.4 nozzle? I have even seen that and it was fine. Maybe some testing would be worthwhile.
I did tests. So exactly on that.
Tested. So why do we even have different nozzle sizes? Why not just use a 0.4 for everything?
It'd be so simple. To a certain degree, that's possible. But at some point, back pressure is going to be higher in the nozzle itself because you restrict the flow with a smaller nozzle, and that's going to lead to different phenomena, maybe even Melswell, it's going to be bigger, yada, yada, yada. But I'm totally okay with that point. I think, and I think that is also what the Arachnislicer is doing. They are using the extrusion width way more dynamically as we did it in the past. And and are also then taking more advantage of just the capabilities of the machine. At some point, you're going to get back pressure problems. That's what you're seeing when you're just making flow tests with different nozzle sizes, what I have done, for example, in the past. But also, of course, the nozzle tip itself smears the material a bit over the surface. And if your extrusion width is bigger than the nozzle tip, it's gonna just bulge out to the side, and it's not probably gonna give you such a nice top surface finish. But what's your take on that?
The two areas that I think are gonna give you real trouble if you use the wrong extrusion width, because there is one extrusion width that is correct for a nozzle, and it's about the nozzle size plus minus 20% typically. Automakers use a bit lower, Prusas use a bit higher extrusion width than the nozzle size. Is overhangs.
Yeah.
Because you have, if you have one layer and the next one is shifted to the side, if you have a small nozzle, it might just shoot your plastic right past the one below it, instead of catching with that edge, with that wider nozzle or orifice. It's not going to catch on the edge, it's just going to drop right past. So overhangs are going to be, especially the super shallow overhangs, those are going to give you more issues if you're printing with a larger extrusion width than your nozzle is made for. And stuff like bridging, which also plays into it when you have like top layer infill or top solid infill over sparse infill, because that is also bridging. Because you can tune your slicer to actually stretch your filament more. And I mean, I guess essentially you're printing at a lower extrusion width, then that's setting you want to do. But yeah, because you're not, your extrusion diameter, the stuff coming out of your nozzle, that rod is going to be smaller than you're expecting. You're going to get more linear flow, so it's just going to droop between the infill lines. You're just going to get droopies instead of that line getting stretched. Those are the two areas that I can see issues with. Then, of course, back pressure, etc., etc. Other than that, yeah, if you the theory works out. If you're doing like a first layer, I always print at like 2x nozzle size, at least, because there you have a solid back and you're pressing your extrusion line against something and it just pushes down on it. But once you have like actual 3D geometry, once you're printing onto existing layers, it's not going to be as great as using the actual proper nozzle. You do have some leeway. I think a 0.4 out of a 0.5 line out of 0.4 probably is going to work. But at the same time, you could also just speed up your printer a bit and you'd probably get the same quality output. Because, like you said, back pressure, you're going to get more control out of a 0.5 than out of a 0.4.
One result of the investigations that I did was that using higher extrusion widths doesn't help you with layer adhesion. But the thing is, if you're having a part and you're for example just using two perimeters, those perimeters gotta be wider, so you're basically adding more material, which gives your part more strength with the same number of perimeters. And this is definitely an advantage of that method.
So you're basically laying down more material faster.
Exactly. So if you're using a 0.6 millimeter extrusion width on a 0.4 millimeter nozzle, two perimeters at 0.6 millimeter extrusion width gonna be the same strength as three extrusions with like a 0.4 millimeter extrusion width.
Yeah, you're gonna get 1.2 millimeter total width either case. So, the one thing maybe I'm still wondering about is with infill. So if you have, say, a typical 15% infill ratio, if you have a smaller extrusion width, you're going to have a finer pattern. You're going to get top layers more closely supported, not with a thinner track, but it's going to be finer. And also you're going to make contact in more spots with the external perimeter. Is a thin line extrusion with a finer pattern better or worse than doing the same percentage with a thicker nozzle and then having larger walls but more distance? And my thinking is a finer pattern is always going to be better than a coarser one that uses thicker lines, especially where it makes contact with the external walls. You get like spot deformation if you have a load that's just a point. It's going to bulge easier, it's going to do weird stuff more easily. So in that regard, I think either putting a 0.6 nozzle in or using just a wider extrusion width could actually degrade your prints. But I've not done any testing on that. I don't know for sure.
But that's the beauty about, our slices, that we can adjust the extrusion width dynamically. So I think for bridging, we could adjust the flow rate or the extrusion width so that we don't have the issue that you just talked about. Yeah. For infill, we do have the possibility to change it as well. So we could just adjust it for the regions where we think it is important.
Yeah. So it's not
why
gonna be,
would you use...
It's not going to be the exact same as using the proper nozzle. But I think if we do that, we might be able to get maybe 60% of the speed gain as actually swapping in a bigger nozzle.
Yeah. So...
Roughly 60%. Maybe 62%. I don't know. Might be slightly off there.
So definitely, yeah, play around with that. It's interesting. And I've seen it. I've seen the most impact on really the strength of parts if time is also what you're concerned of. Because, with the same amount of perimeters, you get more wall thickness, which is going to make you thicker parts, but also stronger parts. So. Yeah.
Now, what about printing a 0.4 line with a 0.6 nozzle?
I think to some extent that might work. It would be interesting to see in which areas of the print it's gonna really make a difference. Interesting point.
You're probably gonna get really poor layer adhesion because you're basically so. You're not squishing down the filament enough. Yeah. That would be my worry. You're laying down not enough filament to like fully especially at larger layer heights.
Yeah.
At like a 0.15, it probably is not going to matter much, but yeah, you're not squishing it enough. That would be my concern.
At 100% infill, I think it would not make a huge difference because sure. It would anyways fill it up. But yeah, you are right. This could be a thing. And to a certain degree, it is used in the Arachne slicer. And I have also seen that, I think, in the past with the standard Ultimaker profiles, that they sometimes use thinner extrusion widths at specific sections than the nozzle that's installed.
Though Arachne uses it only in very specific cases, and for example, for gap fill, it has well if you have a thin wall and you have one perimeter either side, it uses that basically as a channel that it just fills out with filament. The nozzle geometry at that point doesn't matter at all because it's just it is just filling that gap that it has there.
Cool. So, last one. Or have we finished?
No, we've got one more. We're come on, we've barely made it over an hour.
So, Franco Oteola is asking, anyone is going to give a chance to the positron printer. For anyone who doesn't know what the positron printer is, I think you have seen it being featured on several news outlets and not YouTube channels. It's the upside down printer that basically fits into a filament box.
Yeah, and we've talked about it on the podcast too briefly a couple episodes ago, and well, a couple months ago at this point. And it back then it was the V1. There was explicitly proof of concept. There's like notes there. Please don't try and build this. V2 is coming. We're at V3 now. So it's a design, I guess, that is proven or refined to a point where you could try building one. You mentioned that it's not that easy to build, maybe.
I think it's not that easy to build. I would really like to build one because I just find it fascinating to watch, but I think there are certain challenges you need to overcome. So the motion system is, I think they're using fishing line for that.
The Dyneema, something like that, yeah.
Something like that. Then the hot end itself is custom, which has a 90 degree bend in it. Then the printing platform is glass with copper, I don't know, copper lines somehow mounted to it for heating, so, but I think that's mainly for aesthetic
glass purposes. PCB, essentially.
Glass PCB.
I mean, you could use aluminum there, no problem.
Could use aluminum there, but then it would be really hard to take a look at the first layer because then you have to turn the printer upside down.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of custom parts at the machine, which makes just reproducing one more challenging than just copying a Prusa Mark III or something like that. But the nice thing is that also I think the version 3 of the positron printer is open source and it is not restricted for, well, that it can't be used for commercial purposes. So basically anyone who wants to sell one of these can build the parts and would be able to sell kits. And I really hope that some Chinese manufacturer jumps on board and might be able to release a kit for the positron printer. Because even though it's not groundbreaking in its, I don't know, in its, I wouldn't say, in its motion system, it just looks differently, and the possibility to just fold it down to a really compact size, something we haven't seen before.
It's a very cool machine.
It's a really cool machine.
With the, what are you mentioning with like the non-commercial or commercial license? I never know whether like showing a build or showing a print of a model, even of a non-commercial design, is legit. And we've talked about this before, and we've gotten answers like, hey, yeah, just ask, but yeah, different things. So thankfully, this is like totally cool. CC what was it, attribution? Yeah. Not share like Creative Commons attribution. Absolutely awesome. So I don't know. I do have the tools to make the hardening stuff, I guess, with the lathe and stuff, but I don't know.
It's going to be a bit involved.
But it's very involved. I don't know if I have the energy for it. Yeah. So no plans to build one right now, Stefan. I don't think you have any plans for it either.
No, even though I would like to, but yeah, time's always a problem. But if anyone at some point, I don't know, reads anywhere that a kit is available, please let us know. I would be happily taking a look at one.
All right. So you know where to leave those comments? Either if you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment below there, or tweet at us at the Melt Zone. We're always welcoming your comments, questions, inspirations, whatever you want to send in. That is it for this episode. We have successfully once again managed to exceed 1 hour. We have answered all the questions we have. I guess all that's left to say is thank you, Stefan, for your time.
Thanks for yours.
If you want to support us, you can do so through the Patreon links down below or channel memberships on our individual channels. Again, all linked below. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Subscribe, like, do whatever. And we will see you all in another 2 weeks, ideally, if all goes well.
Perfect. See ya.
Bye.